The station that makes you feel good.
Apples and pears, beef and skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, Ant and Deck, fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com. Strawberries and cream.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
I think that the health is one of the most important concepts that needs to be cleared in order to make a bridging between modern and traditional knowledge, such as Ayurveda, but also to better understand the way that we may have to help our patients and to cope with the general health. Mm-hmm. For modern medicine, health can be only absence of disease, but this is not a very precise definition, because you may not be ill, but you may have a lot of problems that are not defined.
Yes.
Another definition is the one of the World Health Organization that actually has been taken from Ayurveda, that is that health is not only absence of disease, but is a complete state of wellness from a physical, mental, and psychological and spiritual point of view.
So in practice, you know, for someone like you who's a neurologist,
yes,
where you'll have such little time,
yes, yes,
really to have contact with patients,
yeah,
how do you ensure that with your philosophy of this holistic health, mm, how are you going to apply that in practice?
Yes, in practice, because we have to find, as I was telling you, something different from this definition that I was telling. This is because only in this way we are able to apply in the practice. Mm-hmm. So if we are not satisfied with health as absence of disease, if the definition of the WHO is too utopic, because, you know, someone,
yes,
that is complete is that. So we have to find. And we made a big study on this. Actually, we published a book that has been edited by Springer, mm-hmm, in 2013 about this theme.
What's the title of the book?
An Integrated View of Health and Well-Being.
Uh-huh.
And that is a book that has been edited by me and Professor Narayana Nambi.
Right.
And there are also chapter by Professor Manohar inside, and also from Western doctors and psychologists.
So this book really kind of integrates the opposing or contrasting paradigms.
And what came out, what is really important for the practice, the general practice, that a common definition of health that satisfies both the modern and the traditional system of knowledge is that health is resilience. That, uh-huh, means the capacity of an organism to adapt to the change of the environment.
I think, you know, you have hit an excellent point, because what you have just said, Dr. Antonio Morandi, is that while we can keep looking at the theoretical understanding or, mm-hmm, the utopic idea of health being, mm-hmm, perfect, mm-hmm, but in practice, it is to measure whether I have the resilience to adapt to my environment, because as humans, we have only been able to survive because of our intelligent way to evolve and adapt.
Yes.
So how do you in practice make sure that you teach or you support your patients to become intelligent, to adapt to the environment?
When I was working, I remember in a hospital, I was more than 20 years ago, I was working in a unit, in a stroke unit also. And in that unit, there was a group of people that were working with people that had a stroke. That means people that were without the use of half of their body.
Yes.
And there was, and this group was a self-help group.
Mm-hmm.
In this self-help group, we were teaching to these people, to these people that had a stroke, not to live like a man with 50% capacity, mm-hmm. but to be to use the 100% capacity of one leg.
Right. Yeah.
So and so
explain that a bit more, because I think, you know, this is exciting. Because, you know, we believe that, you know, we have this very quantitative approach
yes.
towards understanding a human being, that if everything quantitatively is fine, then that person is complete. But you're talking about somebody who we would think has a physical disability because...
For example, if you are in a wheelchair...
Yes, yeah.
That this means that your resilience is different than if you are if you have the possibility to use your legs.
Yes.
That means that your resilience is set to another level.
Yes.
That means, since that is a chronic disability, mm-hmm. that you have to start another 100% because you have another situation that allows you to have another 100% of your health anyhow. That is the 100% of health of a person that is in a wheelchair.
Uh-huh.
And you may have a healthier person on a wheelchair than a person that is using legs. Because I can be a person in a wheelchair,
yes,
very athletic, that is doing a sport, that is exercising, that is very active, and that is very healthy.
Yes, yeah.
And I may have a person that is walking on his leg, that is obese, that is having a problem with, you know, with a food problem, a nutritional problem, or mind problem. And that condition, even if he has two legs and he moves around and he freely moves everywhere and he looks healthy,
yes.
is less healthy than the person that is on a wheelchair. This means that you have to have two different approaches to these people. You cannot use the same approach to the person in a wheelchair and the person that is walking.
So I think you are really trying to also somehow indirectly indicate that we have a problem when we take the entire population
yes.
as the standard and look at the statistical average as to decide
yes.
What is normal. For instance, yes. you know, we did that mistake in the UK, I think several decades ago, that we decided the blood pressure is of a certain reference range, but this same normal reference range was high blood pressure, hypertension in a tribe in Kenya. Because, you know,
yes.
for them, they would actually be exposed to cardiovascular risk factors if what we in the UK considered as the normal range of blood pressure. So that's exactly
perfect,
what you're saying.
Perfect.
It's very personal. It's highly individualized.
Yes, yes, but even is even more specific of what you said, because what were you saying is about a different, you know, ethnological group.
Exactly.
I'm speaking about a different of each individual.
Within the same,
with the same
demographic
group
commonalities.
Yes.
Right.
Because me and you, we look the same, but we have a lot of differences.
We don't look the same, Antonio.
Yeah, okay.
You're white, I'm brown. You have a mustache and I don't. But, you know, as humans, yes.
Yes,
yeah.
We're humans. Yeah, we are humans. Okay. Let's say that, yes, we have some differences, but basically...
You're better looking than I am.
That is not true. But anyhow... are you going to cut this?
No, not at all. No.
It's great. Anyhow, but we have a different way to react to the environment.
Yes.
For example, I may be more prone to develop some kind of disease like respiratory disease if I go below a certain temperature.
Mm-hmm.
You may resist more.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is a different resilience. So, but this means not that I am healthier or you are healthier and I am ill.
Yes.
This means that we have a different reaction to the change of the environment.
So you are saying that the risk factors may not have the same effect on all individuals.
Yes, yes. So this means that the doctor has to know everything about the patient.
Right.
So this means that one of the most important things that the doctor has to have has to do is to make a very, very correct anamnesis of the patient. He has to collect all the data of the patient, of the family of the patient, of the work of the patient, of the full how the patient is feeling in his life. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, mind and body are absolutely the same.
Yes.
So there is a very, very strong connection. And all this data together give me the possibility to understand for that patient his level of health.
Right.
That in Ayurveda, for example, it can be called prakriti.
Yes, the individual constitution.
Individual constitution and the individual optimal state of health.
So, Dr. Morandi, say in your practice, a person who has a neurological condition mm-hmm. walks into your surgery.
Mm-hmm.
And can you just, for the benefit of our audience, the way you assess your patient, how different is that from a conventional approach of a neurologist?
I think that, of course, I'm not saying that I know what all my other colleagues do.
Yeah.
But let's say, in general, what is the procedures in modern medicine is to first look at the analysis, you know, the instrumental analysis.
Yes.
And then maybe look at the patients, and on the basis of what derives from the analysis, you go and look and to find some sign in the patients.
Right. Okay.
Okay, yeah. And then you may collect the what the patient says, but sometimes even not.
I think this is for very, you know, for you, because you have done this for decades, it sounds like it's very easy. But, you know, Dr. Morandi, what you're saying, if it makes sense to a lot of us, it's just fascinating, because what you're saying is, as a conventionally trained medical person, whoever it is, there is a tendency that we superimpose data onto the individual.
Yes.
But
yes.
I'm assuming you do the opposite.
In fact, what I do is what was suggesting Hippocrates.
Uh-huh.
Hippocrates was suggesting that, was saying that the worst thing that a doctor can do when he meets a patient is to think.
Tell me more about it.
Because when you meet a patient, you have to feel. You have to receive data without the interference of your ego, of what you think. Otherwise, you will look only what is in your mind, not what the patient is telling you.
Mm.
So you have at the beginning, at the real beginning, you have to collect data without judgment. Then, later, when you have all the data, you think. And you put together everything, and then you make, you know, you go in deep, you make an analysis or semiotic or other things to confirm or not what you have seen.
Right.
In this way, you can build a picture of the patient from every side without being, you know, very, very specialistic and too much pinpoint, but losing, you know, all the picture of the whole situation of the whole patient.
So in your practice, Dr. Morandi, when you apply this mm-hmm. particular perspective of not to think, but to feel.
Yes.
And to be this conduit or channel that mm-hmm. kind of just simply mm-hmm. Assimilates and understands. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, in the truest sense, good listening
mm-hmm.
To your patient. Have you, in the way you treat them, do you see any difference once you have done this?
Yes, of course.
Can you give me an example of, if you didn't do or take this route, but mm-hmm. you just did the traditional or the conventional, going through analyzing the lab tests and mm-hmm. imagery
mm-hmm.
and then just, you know, ruling out certain mm-hmm. conditions to arrive at a particular diagnosis mm-hmm. and then to look at what is statistically proven to be the best treatment and give that,
mm-hmm.
to your approach,
mm-hmm.
Where you use Ayurveda and your holistic approach,
mm-hmm.
How would the treatment differ? Give an example.
An example is that the symptoms that two people are presenting, even if they are equal, they may derive from different roots.
Uh-huh.
And if I give the treatment only basing my assumption on the symptoms, I may give the same treatment and may work in one,
mm-hmm.
and may not work in the other one.
Even if it already has evidence base.
But the evidence base is not 100%. It's never 100%. Did you ask yourself why? Did you ask yourself why you need a statistical analysis? Did you ask yourself why when you make a statistical analysis you have a plus or minus the standard error or the standard deviation?
Mm-hmm.
Because we are not all the same. Because you have an average answer in which you can fit a lot of people that have a good response to that, but you leave out all the people that do not have that response.
Right. I think, you know, that what you just mentioned, Dr. Morandi, maybe we need to break it down a little bit for our audience. So, because, you know, every patient today, when they go to a doctor or even to a complementary medicine practitioner, yeah. they would ask, is there evidence? But what you're saying is, in evidence, you arrive at a statistically significant percentage,
mm-hmm.
but then there's a range.
Mm-hmm.
And from what I hear, from what you're mm-hmm. saying is, you know, we call this the odds ratio, mm-hmm. and there's 95% confidence mm-hmm. interval, but then there's a range, mm-hmm. and the range has a bottom end and a top end.
Yes.
And what you're saying is the difference between those who sit at the bottom end
mm-hmm.
of this range to those who are at the other end
yes,
of the spectrum
yes.
can be very different.
Very different.
Therefore, evidence-based medicine may not always work.
Yes. Yes, may not always work, and not only that, but can... it's not always, but it can be even very seldom.
Really?
Yes, because sometimes there are in many diseases in which there are still, you know, some kind of, you know, treatments or a therapeutical strategy that are under experimentation, or they are the best that is known,
mm-hmm.
but they do not fulfill, they do not cover
yes.
A lot of, you know, of the population that is sick of that kind of disease.
Yes, yeah.
I make you another example. Let's take something very simple like a headache.
Yeah.
How many people are... that is a neurological condition. Many people go to the neurologist because they have a headache.
Absolutely.
And what are they are given? They are given, you know, analgesic. Analgesic, and then maybe something for the blood pressure or something. Mm-hmm. But the problem is that headache is a symptom that may have incredible variety of roots. Because what we have found, for example, that a lot of headache that were resistant to drugs, the analgesic drugs, they derive from wrong breathing.
Uh-huh.
Or they were deriving from a problem of bowel.
Yes, yeah.
Or they were deriving from a combination of the two, or from hormonal, from many other things.
Right.
But you can arrive to this conclusion only if you analyze the whole spectrum of the life of the patient.
Yes.
Because if you are stuck to the headache, you will not be able to get to the deep of the real meaning and the real root of that headache.
So
what I want to say is that mm-hmm. the doctor has to spend a lot of time with the patient.
So the moment... a doctor or a healthcare professional start to see conditions as symptoms, we may start to look for other things which may be producing those symptoms.
Yes, yes.
I'm really curious now to bring this conversation back to what we started with, mm-hmm. and you made an excellent point about good health is about resilience.
Mm-hmm.
So in a state of ill health,
mm-hmm.
I completely got the, idea behind, if you're looking at, say, Paralympics, who are very powerful, very fast, very athletic,
mm-hmm.
and someone who is kind of has all the body parts mm-hmm. intact and may not be functioning as well as a Paralympic. I mean, of course, you know. But in states of ill health,
mm-hmm.
do you see a difference in the resilience to cope with the disease, to heal through that illness, and to respond to treatments.
Yes, because of course, if you start from this resilience concept, you point your attention not mainly to the disease, but to the residual health.
All right. So you're looking at what's functioning well, as opposed to what's not functioning.
Yes. So, and then you help what is functioning well to enlarge the possibility and to enlarge the increase the resilience.
Right.
So you use the resources of the body, of the person, to fight the problem. You don't fight directly the problem. Which is much better, because you give the person the possibility to keep on going. Instead, when you fight only the disease, you just substitute yourself to the person, and that person will need drugs forever.
Yes, absolutely.
Instead, in this way, you reinforce what is left good in the health of the patient, and then you try to increase that health, you try to increase that amount of resilience. And sometimes you can arrive to have it back 100% of his personal resilience. Or if he's a chronic disease, you arrive to a certain point, then you reset that at 100%. For example, I am a diabetic person. Diabetic person is a chronic condition, but I can be unhealthy diabetic person. That means a person with diabetes that live with that diabetes at 100% of the possibility of that person.
Absolutely. So I think, you know, this is about comparing oneself with themselves, as opposed to comparing with someone else or a completely different variable of another population.
Yes.
And I think, you know, I'd like to make one important point here. You know, there's been a lot of debate of late that particularly in cancer research, that the representative sample of the research participants usually are educated, they are white, and they have more financial means to be able to participate in these studies, and therefore it may not work well in a person of a different race, with different genetic makeup and with different socio-environmental situation. So what you're saying is extremely pertinent, Dr. Morandi, particularly for patients to understand that just because, say, one is diagnosed with Parkinsonism or Parkinson's disease, from that day onwards, they're not just Parkinson's patients.
That is very true. You know, one of the worst problems of modern medicine is the definition of health. Because the health is when you are without the disease.
Yes.
So, if you are a chronic disease person, you are always sick.
Yes.
There is no possibility for you to become healthy.
To be perfectly healthy.
To be perfectly healthy. And this, also from a psychological point of view, that means also from a physical point of view, you know, as a consequence, you will be never able to live your what is left of your life at a decent level.
Yeah, you know, when you talk about this, it really kind of makes me realize we do apply this concept when it comes to non-living aspects of our materialistic life. For instance, you know, in the UK, we have all these listed buildings. And to be honest, you know, they are very difficult to maintain. If you were to really take an economic decision, you would rather demolish and rebuild something. But then because of the heritage, you know, they have been maintained, and we look at what's functioning well, and then to actually make sure that the buildings stay strong. But we don't apply the same common sense when it comes to health. When it comes to health, we treat our bodies even of less value than a building.
Absolutely, yes, absolutely. You are right. And you know, with this concept of health as a resilience is not only something that you can apply to disease, but is something that has built in the most important concept of medicine that is not applied by modern medicine, that is prevention.
Right.
Because if you have, if you are aware of your resilience, you are able to maintain that resilience. Because you are able to understand what makes you strong.
So you are saying one needs to even to start with have an understanding of what their level of resilience is.
Yes.
Can you actually measure it? Can you define it?
You are asking me something that is very Western, to measure it. Actually, you can feel it more than measure it. But I can make, if I can speak very little about an Ayurvedic concept.
Surely, yeah, please do.
I will tell you what is something that can be a suggestion of what we can do in everyday life, no, to be healthy. The Sanskrit word for healthy person in Sanskrit is vasta. That means to be stable in oneself. It means that the health state starts from inside, because you have to have that stability that allows you to be able to cope with everything that comes from the outside.
Right.
Instead of building wall against enemies, you have to build an internal solidity that allows the walls to come by themselves. And to build this internal stability means that you have to know yourself, to stay within yourself, and to make a kind of inner awareness. So, of course, what I'm saying is that if you want to be healthy, you have to stay stable with your mind.
Yes.
That means stable with your body.
Mm-hmm.
That means that you have to be here and now.
Mm-hmm.
And that you have to be very aware of the fact that even if the mind is something beautiful, it's only an instrument of the intelligence. And the intelligence is the real root of resilience. While mind, that should be an instrument of the intelligence to allow man to do what everything has not to overcome to this intelligence.
Yeah.
So we have to be aware of the fact that we have to keep our mind very well controlled. If we control our mind, we control our health.
So but what do you mean by control? Because, you know, in the modern Western concept, controlling mind is to deny emotions, to be very disciplined.
No, it's nothing like this. I make you a very simple example that is very difficult, by the way.
In practice,
but it's the root. Is, for example, to accept the reality.
Right.
To accept the things as they are, not to look for what you think, but why things are not the way I would like.
Yes.
To start accepting the reality for what it is. That is the first step to modify reality.
Yeah, you know, what you're saying has such a huge impact in practice.
We have to think that the present is due to the past. But the present is the past of the future.
Yes.
So if we want to have a nice future, we have to have a nice present.
Mm-hmm.
Because otherwise, if you do not live in the present, there is a big problem. Because our mind goes always up and down between past and future, past and future, past and future. Never stay in the present. But mind define as the body has to be. Because, you know, we perceive the reality with five senses, the perception are integrated in the mind in a model of reality, and through this model of reality, the mind define how has to be the body to answer to the stimuli. So the body is an expression of the state of mind.
Yes.
And if the mind is in the future, that means that it's somewhere that does not exist, or is in the past, that is, there is a place where it does not exist anymore. Mm-hmm. This means that the body will never be adapted to live in the present.
Yeah.
But we live in an imaginary situation in the future or in the past.
Yes.
And this instability the body is not adequate to live the present.
Yes. You know, I mean, this again, we can link back to what you have been talking about, mm-hmm. which you have highlighted in a very scholarly book, mm-hmm. Is about resilience. Mm-hmm. Is, for instance, you know, I see in my own practice that ambitious, mm-hmm. goal-oriented and high achievers, mm-hmm. when they, for some reason, at some stage are diagnosed with, mm-hmm. say, Parkinson's disease or Parkinsonism, mm-hmm. the biggest struggle would be to actually accept it.
Yeah.
And the moment they actually come to terms with and accept, the exact thing what you have been, mm-hmm. saying is they start to focus on the good bits, the good parts that's working. And then they start to respond to treatments. That brings me to ask you a question as a neurologist, Dr. Morandi, is why do you think that in Parkinsonism or Parkinson's disease, despite giving them, you know, all different, you know, traditional medicines, the new generation of disease modifiers or, you know, dopamine, L-DOPA and all of that, still the response to these medications like Maldopa or Rekvip is so different from one individual to the other?
Because as I was telling you before, we are all different. And if I was a neuroscientist, so I was working in the lab with, mm-hmm. the cell culture, with, you know, animal models, with everything. And what I realized from this experience is that this experience is fantastic for the experiments, uh-huh. but when you bring it back to the patient, it's a disaster.
Right. So what works in a petri dish?
Yeah, I can't mean. Come on, it's very different. It's very different. It's very difficult. When you speak about evidence, mm-hmm. very rarely we have the evidence that something that you find in a model in the lab is 100% useful in the clinics.
And when
you say we are giving the best medicine and everything, it looks like that we have everything, that everything is clear about Parkinson. That is not true. That is everything clear about how a neuron work. That is not true.
Mm-hmm.
We have small pieces. You know, I make an example always when I try to explain the difference between modern medicine and Ayurveda, for example.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying that one is better than the other.
Of course, yeah.
No,
yeah.
Absolutely no. They are two different perspectives.
Yes.
But if I want to make a more detailed example, you know, when you have those square with all the dots with the numbers,
yes.
that you have to put together, then you have a drawing that comes out.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Modern medicine has all the dots.
Yeah.
So that means it has very precise and very real, very true knowledge,
uh-huh.
but no numbers. Ayurveda put the numbers.
Right.
This means that Ayurveda traditional knowledge gives you the possibility to know which point is connected with the other, and at the end to have the picture.
Yes.
So both of them are needed.
Yeah.
But you have to find a way to bridge them. Now, when you tell me we are giving the most the most advanced drug to a Parkinsonian, mm-hmm. we are giving a lot of dots to the Parkinsonian.
Right.
But if we give the same dots with the numbers, we get a different answer.
Yeah. So here is an opportunity for integrating.
Yes, absolutely. But integrating that is not melting together.
Yes.
Is leaving the epistemology, that means the roots of the both system intact, and put them in an interface.
Right, yeah.
Such a way that we may have a kind of new emergent paradigm that take care of both vision in a new vision. For example, if I see you in front for 30 years, the day that I see you in the back, I don't recognize you.
Yes.
So what I have to do? I have to be aware of you in front and in back, but I'm not able to see both sides at the same time. So what I have to do? I have to know very well you in front, very well you in back, and then I have to make a model in which even if I look only from one side, since I'm aware of what is on the other side, I'm able to build a superior model, an inference of you.
That
works. So we have to do the same thing with the traditional medicine and with modern medicine.
Because
if we melt you, the can you imagine your back that is melted with your front? Is a disaster, it's a monster.
See, what you're saying, I think, you know, a lot of my listeners will be able to appreciate. Say you're in a foreign country, and then you believe that actually I don't need to know the foreign language. For instance, now I'm in Germany, I can speak German. And I could think, actually, I've got my Google Translate and I can translate. But as we know, if we translate from our language to a foreign language, the way Google Translate can be disastrous. Although it is trying to be as accurate to individual words as possible. Yes. And this exactly is the problem you're talking about.
Absolutely.
If we are not ready to actually... with a scientific, open-minded, true questioning, sincere approach to understand a different paradigm to what we currently know as conventional medicine, we will be Google translating, creating chaos. And that effort is not going to be helpful for humans.
Perfect.
So you, for example, as a neurologist, you don't just translate Ayurveda, which is an Indian traditional system of medicine, into English or medicine. You like to look at Ayurveda as Ayurveda from its own roots, its own philosophy and principles, and you stay completely true to conventional medicine from its philosophy, then and then you see how the two can interface.
We find, then what I try to find is commonalities between the two systems, not look at the difference.
Right,
I look at the commonalities. For example, like the example between me and you.
Yes.
You know? The difference is the mustache. The difference is the color of the skin.
Yes.
But the commonality is that we are humans.
Exactly.
And that is the most important thing because we can work on that.
Yes.
Not on my mustache, but on the fact that we are humans.
Yes.
And this is the thing.
No, no, that's fabulous. I think, you know, what I must say here, Dr. Morandi, is that although we believe that being scientific is a superior way of being and thinking, the truth is all science also emerged from philosophies. Like all true researchers will know that the current conventional approach to evidence is from meta theories, like post-positivism or positivism. And Ayurveda is based on its own set of scientific philosophies.
But you know, Ayurveda, sorry if I interrupt you, but Ayurveda is derives more from an observation of nature.
Yes, yeah.
And then a systematization, you know, of these observations.
Yes.
There is nothing theoretical in Ayurveda.
Yes, yeah, you're right.
There is not a model in Ayurveda.
Yes, yeah, it's not questioning whether it is true or false.
Yes.
But it's simply understanding how everything works.
Yes, in fact, because, you know, the problem is that we are always looking for, you know, our model in mind. But the problem is that nature does not know anything about evidence, everything about, you know, statistics, anything about medicine, about neuroscience. Nature, these are all human divisions. They are absolutely inexistent. They do not exist in nature. These divisions are made because our mind needs to have this division to try to understand better what is going on.
But what explanations.
But they are not the nature of nature.
That's right.
So what I say is that what we have to try to do is to be less centered on what we think that nature is and to be more listener of what really nature tell us that it is.
How do you tell these things to your patients? Because it's very complex, unless the person is already initiated into this.
No, I don't. I mean, of course, when you are with a patient, you have always to adapt your communication to what the patient can understand.
That's right.
Of course, the most important thing that you have to do is to build a trust between you and the patient, because everything that a doctor does, a doctor, an Ayurvedic doctor, whatever, mm-hmm. you know, all the drugs, treatments, all these things, these are all facilitators. But the real drug, the real medicine, is the doctor-patient relationship. Because this human relationship is what put the basis in the mind and in the soul of the patient to change the situation. So the first thing that you have to do is to find the roots of this human relationship. And then, if the patient can accept something intellectual, you go and explain.
Right.
Otherwise, there will be the trust, the human trust between the two, and the patients will do what you think is good for him, and they will be very good results.
Yes.
But if you treat the patients as a symptom, as a disease, mm-hmm. without, developing this kind of
rapport or therapeutic relationship.
Therapeutic, human relationship. More than therapeutic is human relationship, because you don't have to forget that every patient is therapeutical for the doctor also.
Yes.
Because a patient touch a lot of things inside you as a human being. And so you have to establish this human relation with the patient, being very careful not to project on the patient what the patient touches in you.
That's right, yeah, yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
And because, this confluence is very detrimental to the therapy. But it's very important to establish this kind of
it's trust. It's a collaboration.
Yes, but it's a collaboration based on trust.
Yes,
because sometimes the doctor may ask, very often the doctor asks to the patient to do something that the patient does not want to do.
Yes.
Because very often, the problem of the patient derives from a behavior of the patient.
Uh-huh.
And so if you have to correct that behavior, you may correct it with behavior, with drugs, with food, with surgery, with whatever,
mm-hmm.
is always a correction that the patient does not want to do.
Yes.
And so, the doctor has to have this kind of trust, this kind of, possibilities to communicate to the patient that this is needed, and then he has to do it.
Yeah, it's quite interesting, like how the real sustainable solutions in personalized healthcare, recognizing that actually we are individuals, we are not averages, is to go back to the old school, model of the relationship between a physician and a patient.
Yes.
And what you're saying is, it's very easy just to kind of undermine the relationship between a doctor and a patient as a placebo effect. But if that placebo, or what we choose to call placebo, has a positive impact in producing effectiveness, in changing the person's health, why not?
We have to remember always two things. Actually, one thing we have to remember, and we do not have to forget. That is another thing.
Oh, tell me that
again. We do not have to forget that there exists also the nocebo effect.
Yes.
That means that if I induce in you a negative emotion or a negative impression, I get a negative result.
Exactly, yeah.
And then the thing that we have to remember is that we have to give to the patient what it works.
Mm-hmm.
Not what we think that is good as doctor, because we have to fulfill our ego of scientists.
Right. So you as what, a physician
what I'm
has to
saying,
be flexible.
What I'm saying is placebo works, so why don't we study placebo and we give a placebo to the patients?
Yes.
If it works, why not?
Because you're not then risking adverse effects.
Yes, yes. But the problem is that placebo costs very little.
So it's not profitable at the end. So we are almost coming to the end of this fascinating conversation, Dr. Morandi. But I'd like you to guide my audience in terms of if they were ever to hit this crossroads where they need to seek, say, medical care or health care, because, say, they're diagnosed with a particular neurological condition, how should they make decisions? You know, say, for instance, if I am a patient, how should I take decisions about which way to go forward in terms of, you know, all that we have discussed, the resilience, that we are different, there are different things that work for different people.
You mean also, for example, choosing a doctor?
Yes, yeah. Well, what should, if I'm a patient, after listening to this conversation, my question would be, who do I go and see? And how do I know?
The most important thing, you have to go and see and listen to the person that you feel that can help you. You don't have to look at the degrees, you don't have to look at the success, you don't have to look if it's fantastic, if it's, but only if that person is, gives you something that you can trust.
How do your colleagues react to, you know, such a perspective that you have? Because, you know, to a large extent, healthcare
Italy,
is very
in
political.
Yes, of course. But, you know, in Italy is different probably than from other countries, from the United States, where I lived for several years. This kind of looking for a human relationship is something that is well accepted.
Yes.
Because, for example, I'm not saying that you have to go to the person that, you know, cheat you.
Yes.
Because, of course, you have to have some you know, basic warranties.
Yes, yeah.
Because
the
education of the person is very important.
Yeah.
For example,
you
have to go to a doctor, period, or to a health practitioner, period, and then you have to have the rights to see, you know, the education. But when you have all these people in front of you, you have to make a choice. You have to choose with your heart, not with your mind.
Yeah, that makes absolute sense. So once you
because since you are sick, I mean, you don't have the capacity to understand who is better than the other from a technical point of view.
Yes,
you are an helpless.
You need help.
You need help. So you go to the person that you feel can help you more, not that you think, that you feel that can help you more. For example, when I'm sick, I do not cure myself. Because if I am sick, I'm not able to take care of another person. Can you imagine if I'm able to cure myself?
Yes.
So I go to another doctor.
Yes.
And since the mind is very important, I do not go to a modern doctor because I would, you know, I have something to say on what he says. I'm not going to an Ayurvedic doctor because I have you know, I can question something.
Yes, yeah.
I go to a friend of mine who is a Chinese doctor that practices Chinese medicine, of which I do not understand anything. Mm-hmm. And I go there and I tell him, put all the needles that you want, give me all the things that you want with everything written in Chinese so that I do not understand what you are giving. Because otherwise, I mean, you know, the mind...
Yes.
Is what can create a problem.
It can be an interference. It can
so
be
when I'm sick, I try to get out from the interference of my mind and you know, trust the doctor and leave open the heart open to what everything can feel it.
Now that's fabulous. You know, I'm really glad that a neuroscientist and a neurologist is ready to admit that the human connections are the strongest healers.
Yes, absolutely.
And it's not about just the data. It's not just about science, but it's also about the place of wisdom.
Which is very important in science.
Absolutely.
Are all the dots.
Yes, they're all the dots, but it's making those connections.
Yes.
I think you put it extremely well, a very complex concept into a very easy and simple way to understand and follow. Before I conclude, if my listeners would like to know more about your work or follow your work, where could they go to? Do you have a website address?
We have a website. We have a website of our institution in Italy. It's www.ayurvedicpoint.it.
So it's www.ayurvedicpoint.it.
Oh, you're very good. or a Facebook page, always with the same name.
Okay, I'll certainly be providing the links to Dr. Antonio Morandi's amazing work and project. I wish you all the very best.
Thank you.
And listeners, do stay tuned to more stimulating conversations on health and well-being.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
A for horses, B for mutton, C more cheeks, dig for victory, E bar gold.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle Magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better.
Marks and Spencer.
Add Health Triangle Magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com.
T for two.
Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Sarve bhavantu sukhinaha.